We're talking today here on Sustainable Business Fridays with David Fenton of Fenton Communications. And so, David, we caught you just past your introduction, and I'll let you continue on. Thank you so much.
So as for entrepreneurial spark, at the time in the late 70s, I had just finished working at Rolling Stone magazine as the director of public relations, and I produced a series of benefit concerts against nuclear power and for renewable energy at Madison Square Garden with Bruce Springsteen called the No Nukes Concerts. And I was watching at that time in the 70s the growing influence of public relations firms on the national and international dialogue. And it concerned me a great deal because it was primarily very one-sided. You know, if you were a foreign dictator, you had a PR firm. If you were a greenwashing company, you had a PR firm. And basically, the public interest nonprofit world rarely used those kinds of methods and tactics. You know, they primarily put out facts and reports. And so I thought that this was a terrible imbalance and that there should be something done about it, and it might be a business opportunity too. But really, the social mission was my primary motivation. In fact, I had to be pushed into starting a company by my lawyer at the time. I thought I should just keep my overhead low and keep working out of my apartment. But luckily, he convinced me that there actually was a need for this. So we opened in New York City in 1982, and 6 months later, we opened our first Washington office. I remember our first clients were Mother Jones Magazine, The Village Voice, The Sierra Club, and Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, and a publishing company in Pennsylvania called Rodale Press, which puts out Men's Health and Prevention Magazine. So we were sort of typecast from the start. And we stayed that way, only now we work for major companies and Fortune 500 companies and startup businesses, although the bulk of our work remains foundations, NGOs, nonprofits, and all of our work is about issues. We basically work on issues. So I was asked to explain a couple of basic principles of PR, and I think it's really pretty simple. The most important principle is people only learn from repetition. Without repetition, nobody learns anything. And there's a corollary. Politicians and people in power only pay attention to things that are repeated a great deal. They're sophisticated enough to know that if there's a story on TV one night and it goes away, that they really don't have to worry about that. You know, if you're a corporate CEO and you're worried about your brand equity, a one-time event is really not going to capture your attention. So because this is how people learn, and this is also a primary way that the national agenda dialogue gets set through repetition, the goal of communications practitioners is primarily to create an enormous amount of repetition around a very simple message, all in a relatively short period of time, and to do it through many, many different kinds of outlets and vehicles, all with the same message. That's basically what it's about. Now, of course, the art of it is to find a message that is, as Malcolm Gladwell wrote in The Tipping Point, sticky. Some image that and message that sticks in people's brains that causes them to talk to each other at the water cooler and in our contemporary environment, to share things online with their friends and to make things go viral. And if you can do that and you can make it repeat a great deal, then that's really the name of the game. So that's essentially what we do, is we create strategies to create repetition around sticky messages, to change awareness, to change policy, to change consumer behavior, and hopefully to change the world for the better. So, you know, I'm vastly simplifying, but that really is the essence of it. And you can see it. I have lots of stories showing how this works, but one of my favorite is, about 15 years ago, Senator Bob Dole was championing a piece of legislation that would have made it very difficult for the federal regulatory agencies to do their jobs. And it would have put things into years of court cases and red tape and slowed down and flummoxed, you know, many important regulatory actions. And they called it regulatory reform, and it was sailing through because it sounded so innocuous. And we, working with a very innovative NGO leader, figured out that this proposal was going to make it so that the efforts to clean up the meat supply so that kids would not be killed and made sick by E. coli bacteria were going to be delayed by years and years and years, if not decades, by this proposal. And we started working with a group of parents who had self-organized because their kids had either been killed by E. coli poisoned hamburgers or terribly sickened by them. And we made them the issue, that regulatory reform, so-called, really meant that more kids were going to die from E. coli poisoned hamburgers. And we put the parents out everywhere. And we knew we had won when Bob Dole took to the Senate floor and said one day, "Last night, Peter Jennings on ABC accused me of being a purveyor of tainted beef." And that was the end of regulatory reform. So that's really how it works. That's the art of it. Now let's turn to climate, which I have to confess I'm really obsessed about because I have the fortune / misfortune of spending a lot of time with climate scientists, and I know too much, and I kind of don't recommend it because it'll ruin your sleep because things are very bad and they're happening much more quickly than people realize. And we are way behind in getting people to understand the nature of this and the urgency of it and the solvability of it. And it's a very, very tough situation because climate change is not the kind of threat that humans are built to respond to. You can't see it. You can't taste it. It appears to be off in the distant future. It's kind of all of us. There's no clear enemy. And in many, many ways, it does not trip the hormonal fright response that humans developed in the savannah as we were sitting around the campfire. But it is a terrible threat. And so, for example, here's the kind of threat people respond to. So let's say tomorrow you heard on the news the CIA had discovered that the North Korean government was pumping a dangerous gas into the atmosphere that was raising global temperatures and sea levels and raising the price of food and hurting the economy. What would everybody's response to that news be? It would be, go take those mothers out. Do something right now. But because climate change does not fit the personification of evil and doesn't come across in that mental frame, we're not doing very much about it. In fact, we're trying to dig up every fossil fuel on Earth. We're doing the opposite of what we should. Or here's another example. Let's say that you went to your Google News in an hour and it said that a giant asteroid had been discovered hurtling towards Earth, and it's bigger than the ones that wiped out the dinosaurs, and it's going to hit the Earth in 10 years. What would everybody do? They would demand that we get those rockets up there and knock this thing out of its path. But climate change is exactly like that. In many ways, it's worse because its effects will last for many, many, many generations, and we are not acting on it. So there's a bunch of reasons for this, and I would say that there's kind of a few primary ones. One is, as I said, it doesn't fit the normal threat pattern. And another is that the human nervous system shuts down when it is confronted with an overwhelmingly difficult threat that there doesn't appear to be any solution to. And too much of the messaging that has been done on this has been very, very apocalyptic and overwhelming. At the same time, people will have no sense of urgency about this if the messages are all how wonderful solar energy is and what a great world we could have. So what has to be done, it seems to me, is to find the right mixture of hope and fear. And I don't think we've done it. And it probably we need to be something like two-thirds hope and one-third fear. So this is another problem. And then here's another issue. You know, if you look at successful marketing campaigns, they create an enormous amount of repetition and they guarantee the delivery of the messages to the target audiences. And in the NGO world, we have a situation where actually very, very little money is spent on actually reaching people. The NGOs, their paradigm is basically to have large staffs, and the percentage of their budgets that actually goes into marketing and communications is tiny. You know, a $120 million a year organization might spend $3 million on it at the most. Now, of course, if you're marketing a brand or moving product, you would never do things that way. So you have a kind of a situation where people in NGOs who don't come from business school or marketing or even cognitive science backgrounds kind of have the impression that people have heard about a problem much more than they actually have, and that they sort of take it for granted. I mean, I give you a quick example. Parents know that you can't feed your kids too much tuna because it's full of mercury. But really, how many of you know where the mercury in tuna comes from? Probably very few of you. And the answer is it comes primarily from coal-burning power plants, which put it in the air, and the mercury goes into the water and up to the top of the food chain to tuna. So I was talking to the head of a major environmental group the other day, and I was explaining this problem, and he said, "Well, David, what do you mean? Everybody knows where the mercury in tuna comes from." So these extremely wonderful people who are very dedicated and working full-time on these causes that are vital to the future of civilization and the economy are at a disadvantage because they're up against very evil marketing geniuses who actually know how this stuff works. So this is part of what I think is needed here is to get more of these organizations to bring more people in who know how to do this work and to spend a greater proportion of their budgets on doing it. So before I go to questions, I would just add one other thing that's part of this climate challenge, especially to your generation, which is we have a very big problem, and his name is Rupert Murdoch. The primary source of confusion and disinformation in this country about both the nature of the climate problem and its solvability is News Corp. It is the Wall Street Journal, and it is Fox News. Basically, these outlets almost never tell the truth about these things. They are on some wild campaign for reasons that I really don't quite fathom to continually confuse and distort information about this. If you were to read the Wall Street Journal, 2 million copies a day, the largest newspaper in the United States with by far the most influential audience, the leaders of American business, on the editorial pages, climate change is a hoax. Carbon dioxide is good for you. The more the better, the greener the world will get. And if you read the news pages, basically you won't read about it at all. And when it comes to solutions in renewable energy and energy efficiency, they are mocked and they are only reported when there's something negative to say about them. Now, of course, Fox News is even worse, and it creates this alternative false reality among our politicians and is a big reason why the vast majority of Republican members of Congress do not believe humans are changing the climate. You know, only 40% of Americans believe humans are changing the climate, and only 12% of them believe it strongly. So this is the biggest sustainability communications marketing business challenge of our time, and I hope you all help with it, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, David. This is Ariel. It's all fascinating and terrifying, as you describe it. We're all MBA students with a focus in sustainability. And I think we're all tuned in to the climate change issues. We may suffer some, not deeply as much as the climate scientists, but some of us may not understand the gulf of understanding in the public that you're describing around climate change. Reports keep coming out, like today's UN IPCC report, confirming that what many environmental scientists and those in the movement have been saying is true regarding the unprecedented but predictable rise in global temperatures. Our question as MBA students is, how can sustainably built businesses that are practicing sustainability, help change the conversation about the nature of the issue, about the urgency and solvability of it that you're talking about? How can sustainable businesses be part of it? What could a PR campaign from a sustainable business point of view do to change that conversation, not just from an NGO perspective?
Sure. Well, it's interesting that right now there's in this country there's almost no unified business voice on climate, on either the urgency of the problem or its solvability. There was a business voice on climate up to the failure of the cap and trade bill to pass the Senate in 2009, and since then there really isn't any. If you were to try to identify a very visible business group that speaks out about this regularly and that ensures that when it speaks out that its message is effective and also reaches people, you'd have a hard time pointing to one. It's a gigantic vacuum. So, you know, one of the things that really needs to be done is for businesses that are involved in green issues and sustainability and renewable energy and energy efficiency, and just who want to see the economy preserved, because as you know, if you read the World Bank and IPCC and PricewaterhouseCoopers and International Energy Agency reports, we are headed for a tremendous economic decline if we do fossil fuel business as usual. But there's no business group talking about this. I mean, here's a related issue. So what I'm about to express now appears to most people to be an extremely radical idea. I guarantee you that sometime in the next few years it's going to be a very mainstream idea, and that is that about 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves that the fossil fuel companies use to determine their equity valuations, about 80% of those reserves can never be burned. They must be left in the ground, or the carbon dioxide blanket around the earth will get too thick, and we will have an uncontrollable situation for centuries. Now, so that means we have this bubble, then we call it the carbon bubble. And if you think the housing bubble was bad, that was $2 trillion. The estimates of the equity valuations in fossil fuel companies that are linked to their reserves is $20 trillion. And at a certain point, either those are going to become so-called stranded assets, or the world's going to face a very, very difficult problem. Now, again, sounds crazy, radical. What? Can't burn 80% of Exxon's reserves? But it's just physics. It's just science. It's just the facts. So,
even more terrifying is that that only represents 24% of the carbon that's untapped. The rest of it is on, I believe, nations' balance sheets, like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about but most of those are in the form of, it's counted in the 20 trillion. It's part of like Aramco, the Saudi company, and you know the Chinese oil companies, et cetera. But still, so here we have a solvable problem. There's no reason that we need to do this to ourselves. We have the technologies to solve this problem, and as McKinsey and others have shown, we finance it properly, we're going to have a much more prosperous world, we're going to have a giant infrastructure boom that's going to employ a lot of people, and the price of energy, again, if it's financed properly, is actually going to go down because there'll be no fuel cost and no price volatility. But that message is missing. How many people hear that? And the environmentalists can say it all they want. They don't have economic credibility. So the formation of a business group, and it doesn't have to be everybody, it just needs to be a coalition of the willing, I would say is a very important thing to be done.
David, let me just jump in here. What about BICEP? Is that, I mean, that is the organization that remains after the collapse of U.S. CAP or whatever it was.
You know, I'm close to this, and I have to tell you, I don't even know what that is.
Oh, you don't? Business?
BICEP? Isn't that what you do when you're, like, lifting weights?
I miss businesses for climate, and it's Nike and Levi's and some other companies that officially, I think they're allied with Sirius, and they have some public voice that they weigh in on climate policy, although there is no national climate policy discussion anymore, but that is it.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that, but again, you know, it's so infrequent as to have very minimal impact. And we need something that's visible. You know, I'd like to see a group of people raise some money and start buying advertising on the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. So since they won't tell the truth about this science, we should. And it doesn't even cost that much, you know, especially in the advertising recession. You'd be amazed at how cheap it is to do that. And, of course, if you were to buy ads on the op-ed page of the journal and explain in sober and clear and, you know, very defensible scientific terms what we face, and the journal would go crazy and attack it, you'd have a great news story, lots of controversy, and you'd finally reach their audience with the truth. But you just don't see things like that happening. You know, we kind of live in our own little world, and we assume people know what we know, and they don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Go ahead, Ian.
I was going to say that, you know, Ariel brought up the IPCC report that came out today with this unequivocal proof of human global warming, human responsible global warming, and we were discussing the idea that Fox News and other media channels are that while this is, you know, more and more evidence of this exists, that this unfortunately, we'll just provide another platform for deniers to refute it, and that there are media channels like Fox News out there that are going to bring up that drama and, you know, cloud the issue. And as PR people, I think a lot of people think that we are strictly media managers, that we look at messaging and try and figure out how to make headlines out of it and how to get it into the news conversation. Are you looking at sort of end runs around some of these media channels to try and find new venues to try and get that repetition of a message out there?
Yes. I mean, I think that's essential, and it can be done. But, you know, it hasn't happened yet. You know, the philanthropic community tends to shy away from controversy. Again, there are exceptions to this, but it's pretty predominant. And also, just like the NGOs spend very tiny portions of their budgets on communicating with target audiences, the philanthropic world also spends very tiny portions of their granting. I mean, it's actually better than it was when I started over 30 years ago, but it's still infinitesimal. So the things that one could do to end run these places are just not happening, either because of budgets or because of priorities or because of a reticence to get involved in these controversies. And, you know, it's interesting that there's, you know, there's not tremendous marketing literacy in a lot of these places. One of my favorite things to do is to ask someone in the philanthropic community how much they think it would cost to buy a 30-second television ad on either Fox News or CNN in the Washington, D.C. metro market. One 30-second television ad on either Fox News or CNN in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan market. Anybody have a guess?
How long? Running how long?
Just
single
one
ad?
Just one. How much do you think?
It's 130 seconds.
130 second ad, just in D.C., D.C., Maryland, Virginia.
Okay, I don't know, 50 grand.
Most people say 10 grand, 20 grand. You just said 50. The answer is $200.
What?
That's right. And if you get a volume buy, it's $140.
Wow.
So now nobody's saying that buying one ad one time is going to do anything, but it gives you an idea of how, you know, yes, within certain very important target audiences, you know, we can affect the perception of reality as our opponents do. You know, if you turn, if you're in the White House or in Congress and you turn on the TV in Washington, D.C., you will only see commercials from oil, gas, and coal. You will not see any other energy commercials. There's just been one giant exception, which is really fantastic. A former hedge fund manager named Tom Steyer has been buying very effective ads against the Keystone Pipeline, and he's figured out how cheap it is. He's even making the ads 90 seconds long, which is unheard of, and we should all cheer him on. But it's that's the first time this has happened. So, you know, to expect policymakers not to be influenced by that one-sided environment is crazy, but that's what happens.
Sort of building on that idea and thinking about the nuance of how to inspire people without burning them out on the sort of fear side of messaging.
Right.
Are there particular messages that you have identified as working that just haven't been widespread around this issue? When you're talking about that balance of two-thirds hope and one-third fear, is Tom Steyer using that well? Well,
he's focused just on Keystone right now. He's trying to create some political space for the president to turn down the pipeline, as I hope happens. But yes, there are messages that have been identified that would be very helpful. I wouldn't say there's been enough research into that, but there's certainly been some. Part of the problem is, you know, as I said before, the basic principle of communications is lots of repetition of a simple message. And we have allowed this climate question, in my opinion, to get way too complicated. So we're on the playing field of how bad will it get, by what century, by later this century, you know, climate sensitivity, cloud cover, all this enormous complexity that just everybody tunes out. And so I think we have to restore this question to utter simplicity. You know, we know that carbon dioxide from fossil fuels traps heat, and it's a good thing, because if it didn't, we'd be freezing. It would be too cold to live here. And we've known this for centuries, that this is what it does. So the question is, how much do we want in the air? How hot do we want it to get? The more we put up, the hotter it will get. So that's the question. How hot do you want it? Now, nobody talks in that kind of simplicity. And again, part of the reason is that the messengers are mostly lawyers and scientists and policy people and people who studied the humanities. And, you know, they know a lot. They're right about so much. But people don't learn that way. So on the solution side, I actually believe that the most important simple message is also the most important policy message, which is we have to make these fuels pay their true cost to society in order to get to the other side. And so there has to be a fee put on these fuels for their social cost. And I believe, both from a messaging and a political point of view, that we have to return that fee 100% to the public, that everybody gets it equally per capita. This is the so-called fee and dividend proposal, which is some people call the clean energy credit, where you put a slowly rising price on these fuels, and the government gets none of the money, not a dime, and all of it goes back to the public so that as energy prices rise, as they must, it does not have an economic impact on most families. In fact, many benefit. So those are some of the things I'd like to see out there, and there are others. You know, it's very interesting, the lack of marketing on these things. You know, you may be familiar with this growing industry called residential solar leasing, where you can now, in I think it's about 19 states, put solar energy on your roof in many locations, and no money down, you get an immediate reduction in your utility bill, and you get a price guarantee that the solar part can't go up in price ever. And that's a pretty appealing formula. And I have to tell you that until very recently, when I would talk to business and environment editors at our major media, they would scoff at me and say, that's impossible. Everybody knows solar's too expensive and will be for decades. There's such ignorance about the very rapid progress being made in these technologies. And this is partly because the marketing budgets of the companies in these fields are tiny. They're focused mostly on direct sales, understandably. And so who's to pay for teaching people about it? Well, my view is that society and philanthropy and government and people that want to see a prosperous world should pay for that. But it's not happening.
Ian, I'm going to jump in. Errol, I'm going to jump in here with a question about Al Gore's group. I mean, they kind of got this, at least conceptually. Could you speak to what you think they've done well and what they haven't done so well, the climate reality sort of folks?
Well, I think Al Gore is, you know, our greatest hero. And you know, if you were to go out on the street and ask people, who do you associate with the words climate change, pretty much the only answer you'll get is Al Gore. Now, that's, on the one hand, you know, indication of an enormously effective activity and person and you know, hero. On the other hand, it's indicative of a problem, which is you're not going to have a social movement if there's only one person identified with it. Either, one, because that's not enough, it doesn't create enough repetition. Two, you haven't sunk into the culture enough if people can only identify one person. Three, that person may not appeal to everybody. So, you know, we should all be very glad that Al Gore has done what he's done. I think that, you know, I know he's been frustrated in not having the resources to do the communications that's really necessary. And he's done more of it than anybody.
I wanted to jump in here and see if we could shift this a little bit in that there are some huge cautionary tales on these macro stories, but there's a number of people listening today that want to, you know, maximize their brands and reputations on a more granular level with their businesses that may or may not be sustainable in nature or sustainably minded. Is there anything we can sort of tie back to some of these lessons, tie them back into something that sort of the average business owner could implement? I mean, other than increasing their marketing budgets?
Well, there's a lot of creative things people can do to create visibility that doesn't take a whole big marketing budget, and that's why there's so many, as you said earlier in the call, the PR industry is growing because it's the low-cost
right.
way to do this. And with the advent of social media, the barrier cost to reaching people is you know, the lowest in my lifetime. So there's plenty of creative things that people can do. There are many examples of it. You know, one thing that you might want to do is study the history of a guy named Edward Bernays. And Bernays was Sigmund Freud's nephew, I believe. And he basically created the term public relations, and he created the industry I think it was in the 19-teens and 20s. And he would, like, for example, he was hired by the cigarette companies, and they wanted to make it fashionable for women to smoke. Women didn't smoke. It was considered unladylike. And so what Bernays did was he hired teams of very attractive women, and he would put them in Times Square and other central locations around the country, and they would smoke in public. and it would cause a sensation, and it'd be all over the news and the newsreels of the day, et cetera. And that, you can trace in history, is what broke the taboo on women smoking, and it didn't cost hardly anything. So there are plenty of examples of that that people can study, and it's more an issue of creativity, really, than anything else. Hey, speaking of creativity, one thing I'd like to ask the students help with is, I don't know about you, but I think this word sustainable is not a good word. You think about it. You know, who in their daily life ever thinks or uses the word sustainable? You know, I kind of put my fingers to my lips when I say it and go, you know, sustainable, kind of like renewable. These are not the right words, and I've not been able to come up what are the right words. And so maybe we should do like a crowdsource contest. But sustainable, surely we can do better than that.
I totally agree. Yeah. We have a branding problem. Sorry, Ariel, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say a crowdsource contest would be great for generating some ideas.
You know, in green, you know the problem with green, right, is a lot of the surveys show that, at least in the United States, men do not respond to green. They think it's like some sissy thing. Women respond to it, but not men.
Or green just equates to spending a lot of green. You know, it's very expensive.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a mental frame for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in here even for a second. If we've got audience calls or callers that want to offer a question, you can raise your hand by pressing 5-star on your phone, and then I can enable you here on the computer. But Ian or Ariel, please carry on.
Well, I have a question. You mentioned greenwashing in when you were talking about the beginnings of your career in PR. It continues to be an issue that we all recognize, and Ian discussed it. Have you noticed any examples of companies having greenwashing be the first step towards actual authentic involvement in sustainability, or has it always just caused them backlash, or have they just gotten away with it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I can't cite examples off the top of my head, but I think that, you know, there must have been examples where companies have not exactly greenwashed, but shall we say overstated what they were doing, and over time those values went deeper in the companies and they did more. But not actual greenwashing. But there's still a lot of it. You know, there's also a lot of real change going on in companies. I mean, heartening, amazing change, especially from my perspective of the last, you know, 40 years of doing this. And we really need it to happen because, you know, the NGOs are not going to make products and services. And so if they're going to be good for humanity and good for biochemistry and good for planetary chemistry, you know, only the private sector can do that. So, you know, one of the biggest changes I've seen is a real generational change in a lot of these companies where, you know, these are heartfelt values and they're leading the way. And I mean, it's really heartening. But then, you know, there's still terrible deception. You know, the British Petroleum, Beyond Petroleum campaign is one of the biggest examples. I mean, that was just all made up. They didn't do anything. And, you know, we had a kind of fun example of this recently. You heard me talk about News Corp before. Well, actually, internally, from what I understand, News Corp's low carbon and sustainability practices are actually quite good. From what I understand, James Murdoch and some of the other executives and the kids are really concerned about this and doing, you know, really good things internally. But it to me, it's greenwashing when this company is the primary source of disinformation about climate repetitively and continuously, you know, in this country and around the world. So, you know, you can be doing some good things and still, in the main, you know, be a really bad actor.
I think that you, Ariel mentioned authenticity. I think that that's a huge issue for brands, especially when we're looking at all the various ways that brands get scrutinized, either through social media or traditional media or just word of mouth these days. There's a lot of critical people out there who are looking at some of these allegations or claims and charges with a whole new jaundiced eye and are being very vocal about these things. I'm wondering how we can, as new brands or working with the more established brands, you know, build in authenticity in some of this messaging to make sure that we are, A, doing what we need to build the brand, but also, B, protecting ourselves from negative commentary outside the brand.
Sure. Well, you know, the honesty is the best policy. Don't overstate. Overstating is your enemy. You know, the best companies do this in a way where they do real sustainability and social reporting, and they acknowledge their challenges and the complexities and the places where they want to do better and haven't been able to. And, you know, that's the only way to do it. You know, as for criticism, there's always going to be complainers, especially on the Internet. You know, you've all seen the comment sections, you know, on Internet sites, and, you know, you have a real disproportionate representation there of people that, you know, are just going to say crazy, unsupported things no matter what anybody does, and they don't seem to have much else to do. I read today that one of the big science magazines had actually just shut down their comment pages on their site because they felt that it was just causing just way too much misrepresentation. So you can't make the criteria, you know, no criticism. That's impossible. But I think if people are honest and forthcoming about their challenges and their prospects, they can minimize that to the point where it's not a big issue. Does that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
As MBA students, many of us are thinking of launching our own companies, and as a successful business owner, just to pivot a tiny bit in the conversation, I'm wondering if you can speak to what advice you have as a Fenton, being a values-led business, you're committed, you've probably given up contracts based on the values you've said that you only work with companies and firms and causes that you believe in. Do you have advice for students launching their own businesses that are committed to balancing the triple bottom line? And does Fenton measure its own triple bottom line?
Yeah. Well, you know, service businesses are different than product businesses.
Yep.
You know, the amount of capital investment needed in a service business is really minimal. And so it's an easier kind of business to grow from your billings or from, you know, pretty minimal investments. You know, product businesses are completely different. And so, you know, that's and I don't have much expertise in that. I've never done that. I do know entrepreneurs who have, and, you know, I know some who succeeded and many who have failed. As for measuring the triple bottom line, we are constantly talking to our employees about their satisfaction and how they think we're doing. We involve the employees in decisions about which clients to take. It's not their decision, but they have a big voice, and we confer with them when there's any question. And sometimes it gets very, very heated and really, you know, very intense, and it's not something that's commonly done in the service business where the, you know, everybody, including the assistants, have the right to opine about whether we should take a client or not. You know, mostly this is self-selecting. Very few clients come to us who have who would be a huge difficult conflict for us. I mean, it does happen, but it's not a common occurrence. You know, we have a reputation, and people sort of know. So, you know, I can tell you that you can be too conservative financially, and that's a big danger. And I've made that mistake of holding back when I shouldn't have. And when you're undercapitalized, you can really do that. I learned to be a little ahead of the eight ball rather than behind it, and that's a lot less stressful in the end.
I've got a question about sort of when one should hire a marketing firm. Because as you say, I mean, nonprofits and other organizations tend to shy away from that kind of expenditure, in part because it's not an advertising campaign in the sense that you can measure, ROI in terms of increased sales. So how do you persuade people of the value of your services? What are the metrics that people are looking for when they come to you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So before I get to the metrics, just a warning. The term public relations is mostly a pejorative term in our culture, right? It doesn't make you think of all kinds of great, honest things. And there are good practitioners, and there's a lot of bad ones. And there's a kind of racket in public relations, which is to write a lot of memos and to bill a lot of time on strategy sessions and to get actually very little accomplished. And this is part of why there's a lot of client churning in the PR business. It's also, unfortunately, because it's viewed as immeasurable and kind of sleazy, those are the people that will say anything for money, it doesn't always attract the best talent. And I hope that changes over time because, especially in our world, we're in a communications-driven world. We need the really top talent in this. We also need it in the NGOs, which is why I wish they would pay people more and have incentive pay and adopt more private sector practices. But as for measurement, in a product-based business, you can measure ROI from free media exposure, from the effects of street teams, from promotions, from contests, from events. I mean, it is measurable in that sense. Now, when it comes to issue perception, it's much more difficult. If you're doing national polling on issues, it can take a long time and a large expenditure till you start to see things change. And sometimes it can be faster. We've just completed a campaign on fracking in New York State, urging the governor to extend the existing moratorium on fracking for gas in New York State. And this was a celebrity-driven campaign combined with a grassroots activist campaign. And when it started, the opinion polls were predominantly in favor in the state. And after the campaign was finished, they had reversed. So some of these things are measurable. I'm of the opinion that not all good things are measurable. And if you insist on measurement of everything, you're going to miss things. Those of you who study marketing, I'm sure, have been learning about the cases where the things that tested badly were very successful. That happens. Some things have to be tried that don't test well, and they sometimes hit. I remember once I went into the home of a very famous television producer, the people that produced Seinfeld. And they had a framed letter from a research company on their bathroom wall saying that we regret to inform you that your idea for this show Seinfeld tested badly and we're not going to go ahead with it. So measurement is important. It isn't everything. Some forms of measurement are very misleading, like focus groups, expecting people to be instantly articulate about things that they've never seen or heard of before. That's kind of a stretch. But it's an imperfect science, and we do need to do it.
Great. We've got time for just one or two questions more. Ian or Ariel?
Sure. I'm wondering if you can point to a brand that's actually, either rehabilitating their brand or building their brand specifically through sustainability and actually doing sustainability right.
Yeah,
for instance, maybe.
Yeah.
I was going to suggest maybe it's something like, I mean, for better or for worse, Walmart certainly has catalyzed its brand through sustainability. Are there others?
Yeah, I think that there's a number of them, and that are associated with more of this. Certainly Patagonia. It's a small company, but this is what it's known for, as well as durability, et cetera. If you look at across the spectrum, there's more of it in Europe. In Europe, sustainability is an absolute mainstream business and governmental value, and they're way ahead. There's certainly more of it here. Walmart's a great example, and Walmart has been very dedicated. What they're doing to the supply chain is transformational. It has helped them with their image problems in other areas. I personally wish they would actually work on those other areas intrinsically rather than just in terms of image. But when it comes to their sustainability work, they deserve to be applauded.
Great. Amarillo, do you have a last question?
Oh, way to put the pressure on. I don't. I just wanted to say thanks for spending your time talking with us today. It's been really valuable, and it's really interesting to hear. I guess I do have one last question. You talked earlier about Abby Hoffman being your teacher and being a myth maker, and I'm wondering if you can end this call on a little bit of an optimistic note around climate change, and if you can tell a story about how it can work, how we can come together, a myth perhaps that we can all buy into for a minute and put some hope into. Do you have?
Sure. That's a good way to end. Look, this is solvable. We have the technologies we need to solve this. And if you look at the roadmaps that have been created by groups like McKinsey and the Rocky Mountain Institute and others, solvable problem. We have the resources to solve it. We're all going to be better off and more prosperous if we solve it. We know how to do almost all of it, and the few gaps that we have, we have time for that innovation to take place if we do all the other things that we know how to do. I think there's no question that if this confusion was not intentionally and repetitively spread in the marketplace unopposed, that the public would be with us. Really, this comes down to really a small number of fossil fuel companies and their agents who have not yet seen the light. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Maybe this is what we should all try to do. So let's try to convince the fossil fuel companies of the following. So the combined, as I said before, they can't use 80% of their known reserves and have a livable climate. And eventually, that's going to get regulated, and their assets are not all going to be usable. So meanwhile, they're spending about $600 billion a year on exploring for new reserves when they can't burn 80% of what they have. Now, according to the World Economic Forum, and I believe the International Energy Agency, $600 billion a year over about 25 years is enough money to transform the entire world's energy system to zero and low carbon. So let's convince them that instead of wasting all this money on new oil exploration, they should spend it on owning the energy system of the future. How's that?
It's a good one to look forward to. We'll work on it.
Okay, David, that's a great job for some messaging. That's a good story to tell. So
they have a business model problem. They're going to wake up to it eventually.
Well, David, thank you very, very much for taking the time to join us today on Sustainable Business Fridays. We're a project of Bard's new MBA in sustainability based in New York City. If you want to learn more about that, you can send us a message at mba@bard.edu or check us out on the web. Next week, actually, we do first and fourth Friday, so that means we actually are up again next week. We've got Alyssa Hammond from Clif Bar. She's their Vice President for Sustainability. Clif Bar is a fascinating company. They actually manage for five separate bottom lines, including environment, community, profit, brand, people. Is that five? And Alyssa will be on talking about that and some of the other challenges and opportunities that they've been pursuing, especially in thinking about transforming the global food system. So join us next week at noon Eastern time. This phone number, please help us spread the word. And David, Ian, Ariel, thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.